This is WCSX Online. Our live web stream begins in 15 seconds.
Hi, this is Brian Elias, president of 1-800-Hansons. Enter our exciting home makeover sweepstakes by clicking on the banner above. You can win the home improvement of your dreams. Windows, siding, roofing, doors, gutter protection. Come on, you can win. Get it done.
And make a visit to any of these suspected cases. And I think if you look at what WHO has done, eradicating smallpox, close to eradicating polio, and does so now adding Gorin in and all these other early disease response networks that they're doing, and they do it with such a small budget. I mean, the budget of the World Health Organization is less than the budget of the San Francisco Health Department, just to put it in perspective. If you look at that, I think there's a lot to be proud of.
That leads one to ask, where would the funding be found to do this right?
Well, we tend to fund the things that we ourselves have seen. If your mother or your grandmother went blind, you tend to want to fund blindness programs. If you've had prostate cancer or you know a woman who had breast cancer, we tend to fund those things. I wouldn't necessarily want to change that. I think that the way that people respond to diseases that have touched them brings out a passion and longevity to their funding. I don't think that's a bad thing. I do think that the world has got to wake up and realize that things have changed. With global warming, with increased travel, with increased commerce, we really are one small planet. There's no question that we are a global village. One might not like the metaphor or the terms, but we need to take care of the health of everyone in the world. The least amongst us is as important as the most amongst us when you're dealing with diseases that are as communicable as these are.
Dr. Larry Brilliant, Executive Director of Google.org. In a moment, we'll head up to Canada to hear about GFIN, the Global Public Health Intelligence Network.
Lord, don't you know? I don't know what to do. You know my doctor, he gave me up, yeah. He looked me in the eye.
You're listening to A World of Possibilities, a production of the Mainstream Media Project. To hear the podcast of this program and to access our show archives, please visit our website at aworldofpossibilities.com or visit iTunes.
We monitor everything from bugs to bombs, says Abla Mawudeku. An epidemiologist by training, she is now manager of the Global Public Health Intelligence Network, an early warning system set up by Canada's public health agency. GFIN is credited with recognizing the outbreak of SARS in China and significantly limiting the spread of the disease. To detect such events before they have the chance to spread far and wide, each day GFIN analysts pore over thousands of news reports from around the world in order to find those aberrations and discontinuities that call for closer scrutiny. To do so, they've developed a remarkable system that picks up on the slightest indication that a disease outbreak or natural disaster may be in the offing. GFIN manager Abla Mawudeku joins us now from the studios of the CBC in Ottawa.
Prior to GFIN, most of the information about early warning about outbreaks was provided through national surveillance systems. Most countries have an infrastructure where information is gathered about the outbreak and then it's analyzed and then determined what the risks are and what response is required. Well, with a system like GFIN, there was reduced delay in that information. We could now get information from media about an outbreak very early compared to data from national surveillance systems. So we're talking of a difference of, instead of months or even weeks, We're now talking of information relayed to public health officials in minutes and hours. What also happened was that now GFIN prototype was developed where it was able to scan all information sources from the internet. However, this information, which would be available to public health officials, still needed to be verified with the country. So the government of Canada established an agreement with the World Health Organization to review all the information from GFIN and then determine what were the potential threats and to ask what response was required. So that was finally the establishment of now not only an early warning system that could alert public health officials about an event that could be a threat, but also the establishment of another component of actually assessing the risk and determining what is the best approach to respond to that threat.
It proved to be enormously effective during the SARS epidemic.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
When we developed the prototype system, we were only monitoring in English and French. And over the course of time, we began to recognize that it was important not only to monitor in these two languages, but other languages, because we were able to then monitor in regions around the world by using different languages. And this became very evident during SARS. So, for example, in November 2002, we picked up a couple of articles in Chinese talking about a very atypical pneumonia or respiratory illness occurring in Guangdong, China at that time. But at that time, it was also difficult to determine, well, how atypical is this, because it was also influenza season. But we continued to receive and to gather a lot of these reports in Chinese. And of course, we forwarded to the World Health Organization and to other public health officials around the world. And it was only in January the next year that we actually picked up an article in English talking about another atypical respiratory illness outbreak in the same region.
How are you finding these articles? Is there a person simply scanning the web all the time or what? Or newspapers? Or
oh, yes.
How are you finding it?
It's an incredible system in the sense that it has two components. There's one component which is automated. So what we do is with a team of analysts, and these analysts are multilingual, they're also multidisciplinary and have expertise not only in public health, but also, for example, in journalism. And they have expertise in understanding the diseases and other public health threats in different regions around the world. So with this team of analysts, they develop a set of search criteria in the different languages we monitor in. And we monitor in English, French, Russian, Chinese, Farsi, and Spanish. So with this search criteria, it's used to monitor and gather relevant information. That's the automated part of the system.
So you use certain kinds of keywords?
Yes, different keywords, and not only keywords, but actually phrases. Because when we think about early warning, we don't at that time know specifically what the disease is or the symptoms. So we have to construct our phrases in a way that we can capture something that's unusual, a mysterious illness, unusual symptoms. So terminology like that is also included with our list of keywords.
Now, you're depending on public information sources. You're depending on the media. Is it sometimes more important to reach the local media level rather than the international, because they may be picking up on these anomalies before the large media do?
Yes, exactly. We not only monitor the national newspapers, but the local newspapers. And that was also very critical with SARS. And that's how we picked up a lot of the early warning about something atypical happening in Guangdong, was from the local newspapers. Very important. Because one of the challenges with monitoring only the national newspapers and the mainstream newspapers is that there's always sometimes a competition of what stories should be posted on the first page or other pages in these newspapers. And when we're looking for early warning, it could be, for example, a case of one person being hospitalized for unusual bleeding in the mouth or something unusual like that. And that's not going to be picked up in the big, huge national international newspapers. So it's important to monitor the local newspapers.
I'm getting this image of a group of people sitting in offices in Ottawa combing over all of this material, and there's a kind of a detective quality to it.
Yes.
Is that the way it really is?
It is. We have a very dedicated team, and that's the other component of the GFIN system. So we talked about the automation of a system which gathers all the relevant information, filters it, and then the question you ask is, well, I mean, if we're picking up information or retrieving information in different languages, how does that get reviewed? Well, we have a machine translation component to our system that actually translates non-English text to English text. And then that information is categorized into what we call the GFIN taxonomy. So it's events about infectious diseases in humans is all put together in one folder and so forth. Then our analysts review this volume of data on a daily basis to determine all of these events that are reported, what could be construed as an alert, and what should we notify public health officials with immediately.
This sounds like the same kind of challenge that intelligence agencies have coming through vast amounts of material, and ultimately you need human beings to discern which of this vast amount of material is truly relevant.
Exactly. It really is. And what we do on a daily basis is we have what is called a huddle, and we love to call it a huddle. And basically, every morning, we gather together and discuss what are some of the issues that analysts have seen that day. So, for example, several months ago, there was an article that initially appeared in Arabic but got translated, and there was an error in the translation. So instead of referring to the event as chickenpox, it got referred to as smallpox. Well, this is where the analysts come in right away, because our Arabic analyst took a look at the article and said, well, there must be a mistake in the translation of the newspaper. Well, in a few seconds, we had our Chinese analyst who quickly picked up an article in Chinese where it was clarified. And the article said there was a report about smallpox in Yemen. However, that was an error. The reporter meant to say chickenpox. And so we were quickly able to produce more information about this error and disseminate it to all our users rapidly to let them know that it's not smallpox. Don't get concerned. It's only chickenpox. And this is where the value of the analysts come in. Since our experience with SARS, I think we've learned that it's important to be able to share information on a timely basis about what could be a threat to the international community. We are a global village, and so we all have to be actively involved in this.
Dr. Abla Mawudeku, Manager of Canada's Global Public Health Intelligence Network. I'm Mark Summer, and this is A World of Possibilities, distributed by the WFMT Radio Network.
The Motor City's classic rock station is 94.7 WCSX Birmingham, Detroit, USA. There's streaming audio from your classic rock home in cyberspace. 94.7 WCSX. Classic Rock Web Stream from 94.7 WCSX.
Wholesale Builder Supply. You've probably never heard of us. That's okay, we didn't expect you to. That's because we've always sold directly to builders. I know what you're thinking. I wish I could buy from Wholesale Builder Supply. Well, guess what? Now you can. We want you to know that we also sell to homeowners just like you. You too can buy your new cabinets from the same company that builders have trusted for years. For directions to our Wixom showroom, please call us at 1-800-722-4405.
To Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Steve Rendell, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, the November 7th Democratic election victories are being credited to everything from the notion that the winning candidates were largely centrist to the genius of Congressman and Democratic strategist Rahm Emanuel. But what was really behind the Democratic victories? Nation contributor John Nichols will join us to sort out the competing storylines emerging from the Democratic election victories. Also on Counterspin today, as pundits slice and dice the exit polls to figure out the big lessons of the midterm elections, one story seems to be eluding the national media. Latino voters made a significant shift to Democrats. What explains this, and why aren't we hearing more about it? Clarissa Martinez of the National Council of La Raza will join us to talk about that. All that's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
While you might despair about the paucity of relevant information available in the media before the midterm elections, there's one thing we did know. John Kerry isn't good at telling jokes. As the media told us over and over again, Kerry's botched joke about Bush's intelligence could somehow plausibly have been interpreted as an insult directed at the troops in Iraq. So it was interesting to hear CBS correspondent Jim Axelrod talk about what should have been obvious. As he put it on the CNN show Reliable Sources on November 5th, quote, "I mean, clearly, if you look at the transcript, John Kerry was in the middle of a series of one-liners about the president. The White House took it and ran with it," close quote. So Kerry was clearly talking about Bush. But when you look at what Axelrod was reporting on CBS Evening News to millions of viewers, he wasn't nearly so clear. As he put it on the November 1st newscast, quote, on morning radio, Kerry was still insisting he was joking about the president Monday night, not slamming the intelligence of U.S. troops, close quote. Why couldn't Axelrod tell it straight when it mattered? Apparently the White House was controlling the narrative.
It sure looked like the GOP's October surprise, albeit arriving in early November. The Sunday before the midterm elections, former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein was sentenced to death for crimes against humanity. In the days before the verdict, there was buzz, not in the mainstream media, about the verdict being pushed ahead to boost the White House's fortunes ahead of the election. That suggestion was laughed off by White House Press Secretary Tony Snow, who wondered if reporters asking about the curious timing were smoking a rope. Snow's dismissal had the intended effect. Reports about the verdict treaded very lightly around the issue of timing. An LA Times report on the verdict, for example, quoted only Tony Snow and an anonymous U.S. official laughing at the idea. The New York Times cited an American law professor advising the Iraqi tribunal, who said the same. But one fact, often reported quietly, should have fed reporters' skepticism. The Iraqi judges didn't produce a written verdict. In fact, a verdict wasn't expected to be ready for several days after the announcement, at the very earliest. A curious reporter might wonder why a verdict would be delivered this way. Are there international legal guidelines on this? Is there an Iraqi legal tradition of releasing verdicts before written verdicts have been produced? These are questions worth pursuing. And reporters will have to get over the idea that Tony Snow thinks they're on drugs for merely posing them.
Well, here's an indication that's not likely to happen for those who still think journalism involves hard-nosed reporters ferreting the truth from stonewalling officials. A visit to a typical White House press briefing would be a real eye-opener. A recent vignette recounted in the November 13th Time magazine provided another reminder of what can be a far too cozy relationship. According to Time's Anna Maria Cox, the morning after North Korea tested a nuclear device, White House spokesperson Tony Snow held an off-camera gathering with reporters, something he often does to provide the administration's take on various issues. Evidently, one of the reporters asked about what they called the massive event, when Snow interrupted them with mock mystification. A massive event? Prodded further on whether it might be at least called a big deal event, Snow finally stated, quote, there was an event, close quote. As Cox points out, such an exchange, a White House official dismissing another country's nuclear test as no big deal, was newsworthy, but it somehow wasn't news. And that's where things get weird. Cox says she asked a reporter why no one picked up on Snow's comments and was told, quote, well, we've come to understand that when he says stuff like that, he's not representing the White House viewpoint. He's just Tony being Tony, close quote. Such polite self-censorship, being so inside that you know without being told which things you're supposed to keep just between you and Tony, is evidently viewed by some reporters as a mark of professionalism. For many, though, it makes the press corps sound more like guests at a private cocktail party than journalists at work.
A radio talk show host who was fired from a Boston radio station after calling a third-party candidate for Massachusetts governor a fat lesbian says his free speech has been violated, and he's hired a lawyer to press his rights in an episode he insists was not a fireable offense. Radio talk show host John DePetro was fired from Boston's WRKO-FM on November 3rd after making the comment about Grace Ross, an out lesbian who was the Green Rainbow Party candidate for Massachusetts governor. DePetro says he made the remark because he was angered by Ross's performance in a gubernatorial debate. In July, after calling a local official a fag, DePetro survived, receiving a mere reprimand from his bosses. But should DePetro be excused for thinking rank bigotry was acceptable on the airwaves of WRKO? After all, if bigotry was a disqualification for being a talk radio host, WRKO would have to lose much of its lineup. The station is home to talk jock Howie Carr, who has been known to refer to Arabs as ragheads, Michael Savage, who says Latinos breed like rabbits, and was once fired by MSNBC for telling a caller he believed to be gay to get AIDS and die, and talk radio behemoth Rush Limbaugh, who once told a black caller to call back when you get the bone out of your nose. Of course, there's one difference between DePetro and these other talk radio bigots, which suggests the station wasn't exactly acting on principle when it fired him. According to the Boston Herald, DePetro's show had low ratings.
And finally, media mogul Rupert Murdoch says he has no regrets about supporting the American-led invasion of Iraq. According to Agence France-Presse, the day before the U.S. elections, Murdoch told reporters that, quote, the death toll, certainly of Americans there, by the terms of any previous war, are quite minute, close quote. Murdoch's offhand dismissal echoes that of the managing editor of his Fox News channel, Britt Hume, who said in 2005 that, quote, by historic standards, these casualties are negligible, close quote. As Fair pointed out at the time, while U.S. deaths were substantially higher in World War I and II, Korea and Vietnam, those were major wars fought either against major world powers or against well-armed states backed by superpowers. When compared to other conflicts in its category, wars and counterinsurgency operations against comparatively weak, isolated nations and guerrilla movements, the death toll in Iraq is strikingly high. Of all the other U.S. military interventions over the past 30 years, which include Lebanon, Grenada, Panama, the 1991 Gulf War, Somalia, Haiti, Kosovo, Afghanistan, none have come close to 1,000 U.S. deaths, let alone the current U.S. death toll in Iraq of more than 2,800. By those historical standards, the Iraq War has been remarkably deadly. Murdoch's comment, and Hume's for that matter, betray the deep cynicism behind things like Fox's drumbeat of criticism against John Kerry's botched joke. Don't expect to see similar saturation coverage of the way Murdoch and his people really see the troops' sacrifices.
Thanks, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. When the Democrats took back both houses of Congress on November 7th, the pundits provided several explanations for the political groundswell. But one key media narrative that has emerged is the familiar claim that Democrats won by moving rightward. As NBC's Tom Brokaw put it on election night, quote, if the Democrats do very well, will it be a huge philosophical shift? Maybe not. Because a lot of these Democrats ran to the center. They didn't run like they were running in 1972 again. They ran as more pragmatic public servants this time. Close quote. Well, who deserves credit for the Democratic victory? The nation's John Nichols analyzes that question and some of the emerging storylines at his blog, The Online Beat, at thenation.com. He joins us now by phone from Wisconsin. John Nichols, welcome back to Counterspin.
It's great to be with my favorite radio show.
John, just for the record, back in 1972, those Democrats were running so crazy to the left, they ended up with 255 House seats and 56 seats in the Senate.
Well, and let me also add that 2 years later, they dramatically increased their position beyond that as people who had made the mistake of voting to reelect Richard Nixon got a great deal of buyer's remorse and voted in a McGovernite Congress.
Well, what can you tell us about the claim that the Democrats won by running to the center?
Well, in political science, there's a term for this. It's lie. And that's the bottom line. It is a complete fantasy that Democrats ran to the center in this election. The fundamental issues that you saw playing across the country was anger at the war. Exit polling shows 57% of Americans want a rapid withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq. It was anger at the Republican handling of the economy. No economic issue played bigger than opposition to U.S. free trade deals like NAFTA, CAFTA, most favored nation trading status with China. And finally, I think a free-floating sense that the Republican right had dramatically overplayed its hand on both social issues and education issues and a host of other matters. Now, where you want to see this in the practical level is take a look at who won elections. Sherrod Brown, who was one of the leading opponents of the war in Iraq in Congress, who is the point man on opposition to the administration's trade deals and most of its economic policies, was elected to the U.S. Senate from Ohio. John Tester, who was so progressive that the National Democrats tried to get somebody else as the nominee in Montana, but Tester beat the other person in the primary on the basis of his anti-war stance and his opposition to the Patriot Act. Jerry McNerney out in California won the Pombo seat. He is somebody that the National Party tried to block in the primary because they thought he was too left-wing, too anti-war. Bruce Braley out of Dubuque, Iowa, who was trailing in his primary election and then won because he put his whole focus at the end on his opposition to the war. Keith Ellison out of Minneapolis, Minnesota, again, trailing in his primary, won that primary by emphasizing his anti-war stance and sailed right through the general election on those same positions. What's the people coming to Congress, in many cases, are more progressive, not merely than the Republicans they're replacing, but in almost every case, more progressive than the Democratic Party.
In a TomPaine.com column, Robert Borisage of the Campaign for America's Future called the Democratic victory a populist anti-war mandate. I would say you don't think he goes too far there.
No, I don't think he goes too far. In fact, one of the fascinating things is that even some of the new members of the House and Senate who ran as social conservatives, people like Heath Shuler out of the Carolinas and Bob Casey out of Pennsylvania, these are guys who actually acknowledged some qualms about abortion and issues like that, on the war were very, very critical. And, you know, Jim Webb coming out of Virginia, who a lot of pundits are trying to paint as some sort of right-winger because he used to be a Reagan Republican. Well, don't forget, what was the reason he got into the race? He said he entered the race because the war in Iraq was such a disaster that, you know, he felt he had to leave the Republican Party and take on George Allen to try and stop it.
Another storyline coming out of this election credits Congressman and strategist Rahm Emanuel for the victory, a narrative humbly embraced by Emanuel himself, as well as by many media outlets. For instance, the LA Times called Emanuel the chief engineer of the Democratic victory. Where do you come down on that question of where the credit lies for the victory? What do you think of Rahm Emanuel's job here?
Well, Rahm Emanuel, who is, of course, a veteran of the Clinton administration and the primary point man for the North American Free Trade Agreement back in 1993-1994, a decision that was embraced, or an issue that was embraced by the Clinton administration and did severe damage to Democratic prospects in congressional elections that year, probably as much damage as any single move, can hardly be called a genius of politics. He has made a lot of mistakes over the years. This year, he happened to be smart enough to be riding on top of the wave, and so he's going to get a lot of credit for it. But I'll just point out that if there was one candidate in the entire nation that he really rolled his dice on, that he got into the race, that he put money behind, that he forced another candidate, or defeated another candidate who had a better claim on the district in the primary, that was Tammy Duckworth, the Iraq war vet, who ran as a sort of murky, not really against the war centrist Democrat. Tammy Duckworth lost on Tuesday. By the same token, candidates who Rahm Emanuel had tried to keep out of the competition, had tried to keep out of the races, and in some cases had refused to back even in November. People like Carol Shea Porter up in New Hampshire and like Jerry McNerney out in California won seats that they weren't ever expected to win, that they weren't given any chance of winning. So the notion that Rahm Emanuel is a political genius or that somehow he really had the feel of the country, I think is very strong in Rahm Emanuel's head, but not so strong in the analysis. If you really look at the races around the country, I think he was lucky to be head of the DCCC this year. He did do some things right. Give him credit for that. But my bet is that there are probably about 200 Democratic congressmen and women who probably would have done about the same thing and probably would have done it just about as well.
John Nichols, one of the key pieces of information emerging from the exit polls is that large numbers of Latino voters shifted from supporting Republicans in 2004 to supporting Democrats in 2006. This should be a big story, but it's hardly received any coverage. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think it's got to be put in combination with some of the other numbers that have come out of the polling as well. Asian Americans shifted dramatically to the Democratic column. Arab Americans shifted dramatically to the Democratic column, a place that they hadn't always been. And so what we see is the actual playout of James Sensenbrenner's really attack on immigrants. You know, the fact is the Republican Party early this year became identified with a militant anti-immigrant position. Those communities, which are in many cases newer, although certainly some of them have deep roots in the U.S., but those communities that have a lot of immigrants in them saw that as an attack on them. And the amazing thing is that the Republican Party succeeded in doing something that the Democrats couldn't do, and that is making a case to Latinos, to Asian Americans, Arab Americans, and other immigrant groups, other groups that have large numbers of immigrants within them, that they had to vote Democrat. And so I would just tell you that my sense is that the best organizer for the Democrats this year may well have been James Sensenbrenner, the Republican congressman who moved that draconian anti-immigration bill. One thing that's not being played up enough in the coverage of the election results is the fact that some candidates who really came to the defense of immigrants, who spoke up for immigrants, did very, very well. Deval Patrick, the new governor of Massachusetts, in his primary campaign, at a time when immigrant bashing was really high on the agenda of a lot of the media and certainly a lot of Republicans, made a very pointed speech on his sympathy for immigrants, his desire to help immigrants, his anger at those who would target them for attack or take away their rights or take away their potential to become citizens. And it's a very interesting thing that Patrick, by his support of immigrants, strengthened his position in a Democratic primary race, identified himself as the more progressive candidate, and then, intriguingly enough, went on to an overwhelming victory, becoming the first Democratic governor of Massachusetts since Michael Dukakis.
John Nichols, you're also co-founder of Free Press, the media reform group. Tell us a little bit about what this election means for media reformers.
Well, it's a very big deal. At Free Press, we organize the National Conference on Media Reform every couple years, and only a handful of members of Congress are regulars at our conferences, but some of the regulars, at least two of the key regulars, have been Bernie Sanders, the congressman from Vermont, and Sherrod Brown, the congressman from Ohio. Both of those gentlemen are now U.S. senators, and there is a very good chance that Sherrod Brown will find himself on the key committee, Commerce, which deals with these issues. And so right off the bat, we have an incredible group of new champions in very powerful positions. In the House, many of the people who are moving to committee chairmanships on key committees are people who have been supportive of media reform, but have essentially been shut down by the Republican leadership in the White House. This is a really golden moment, and it's a place where groups like FAIR, that have a long tradition of critiquing the media, as well as Free Press, that seek to reform the media, are going to be in a very good place, a very good position, to finally not fight defensive battles against the FCC or against efforts to, really kind of colonize the Internet, but to fight offensive battles, to be aggressive in saying, you know, it is time to talk about the dangerous impact of consolidated media and to discuss the value, the American value, of breaking up big media companies and, you know, getting a lot more local control over our television and radio stations.
We've been speaking with John Nichols. You can read his blog, The Online Beat, at the nation's website at thenation.com. John Nichols, thanks again for joining us today on Counterspin.
It's a terrific pleasure to be with you. Keep it up.
Back in April of this year, massive protests in cities across the country drew attention to harsh anti-immigrant legislation passed by the House of Representatives. The turnout at the protest shocked pundits and political observers, and we heard talk that Latino voters would speak up again come November. That storyline, though, seems to have been lost as political reporters sort through the data on the midterm elections. One fact jumps out from the exit polls, though. Latino voters showed a considerable shift to the Democrats over their 2004 elections. What drove them to the polls, and what did it mean on Election Day? Joining us now to talk about this is Clarissa Martinez. She is the Director for State and Local Public Policy at the National Council of La Raza. Clarissa Martinez, welcome to Counterspin.
Thank you for the invitation and the opportunity to be with you today.
Now, the pundits might not have been paying really close attention to the Latino vote. You were, obviously, and NCLR put out a press release on Election Day that offered some indication that Latino voters were motivated to turn out this year. What did you find exactly?
Well, interestingly enough, I think that there had been a very strong push by some politicians to make immigration a wedge issue. And I think a lot of them thought that they could ride all the way to an election win without necessarily having to propose any solutions to that concern, but simply trying to stir up public sentiment and anti-immigrant sentiment. And what we were trying to measure is what was the impact of that kind of action and strategy on the Latino community. And what we found was that indeed the level of engagement of the Republican Party members in taking the lead in an anti-immigrant and anti-Latino strategy was deeply felt in the Latino community on the one hand. On the other hand, with the mainstream public, with the mainstream electorate, that strategy didn't pay off. And there's other organizations that also issued polls on that matter, the National Immigration Forum and the Manhattan Institute, which showed that with the mainstream public, immigration did not create the winning wedge issue some folks were going for. But as you said, it, with Latinos, it had the effect of distancing Latinos from the Republican Party.
And you saw some of the hardliners, especially out in Arizona, like J.D. Hayworth, who made immigration and bashing immigrants their, really their number one issue, lost pretty surprisingly, I think.
And that, you know, that gives us hope that this issue is an issue that is rational, that the American public really wants to see effective solutions, and that they didn't buy into extremist hype. And that's very good, because we know that where some of that divisive sentiment has taken hold, it has created a very intolerant environment that affects not only immigrants but Latinos in general, which is why, even though our poll is of Latino voters, and some of them, many of them are not immigrants themselves, the concern was still there.
It's sort of a winning strategy for pundits and cable news hosts, not so much for politicians. If you look at the exit polls printed in USA Today the day after the election, one of the numbers really leaped off the page. Most of the voting blocks went strongly for Democrats in 2006, more so than in 2004. Latino voters shifted pretty dramatically, a 36 percentage point difference from 2004, according to the paper. You'd think this would get some notice in the mainstream media. I haven't seen this picked up by the media much, which is kind of surprising, I guess.
Well, I think right now everybody is still trying to make sense of what all the shifts are going to be and obviously what's going to happen with the Senate. But we hope, particularly since, you know, the usual thing that happens after an election, which is that members of either party start saying, let's put division and election politics aside and then start working together, that one of the issues that has emerged as the one that could provide that space for parties to work together in a bipartisan manner to achieve effective public policy is immigration. And as we've been saying before, and many folks that have been following this issue, this is one where you need bipartisan collaboration for it to work.
Mm-hmm. Now, one lesson from the protests back in April was that such mobilization can often elude the mainstream media because it's happening in Spanish language media, especially on radio. Was that happening this time around for get out the vote strategy?
Well, the Latino community is a very complex community, not only in its makeup, but also in terms of how it gets its news. The majority of Latino voters actually get their news from English media, whether that be newspapers or television. But a good number in our poll, at least 50%, reported hearing mobilizing messages in Spanish radio and Spanish TV. So I think that it's a lot of strategies working together. There's been a lot of nonpartisan efforts trying to increase Latino participation, and at the same time, the immediate intervention and mobilization around an election, but also the long-term strategies of promoting citizenship among eligible immigrants, as well as connecting the community in general to the issues that are of interest to Latinos. And obviously, we don't just care about immigration. Our top issues are education and the economy.
Yeah, the fascinating thing about the survey that you released is immigration is one of the big motivators to vote, but not necessarily the top concern. The other thing I thought was fascinating, participation in those mass rallies really seemed to be connected strongly with getting out to vote.
Yes, and very important, it was also a big connection with young Latino voters 18 to 24 years old, which is a very good thing because obviously, like the rest of the country, we want to find strategies that are going to get our young folks connected to the political process, and these mobilizations seem to have a very big impact. But as you mentioned, immigration is an issue that is influential because many Latinos see politicians or other leaders' reaction to immigration and the treatment of immigrants as sort of a proxy for how they feel about the Latino community and the level of respect they have for it. And, you know, it's no surprise because every time we have an immigration debate, which normally has very negative tones, it tends to have very negative consequences on all Latinos, regardless of immigration status.
It's a message to Lou Dobbs. Well, we've been speaking with Clarissa Martinez. She's the Director of State and Local Policy for the National Council of La Raza. Visit them online at www.nclr.org. Clarissa Martinez, thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you very much.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. You can listen to Counterspin at FAIR's website at www.fair.org. This show is engineered by Alex Noyes at Mercer Media and co-hosted by Peter Hart and myself, Steve Rendell. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Digital audio on your desktop.
Computers can do that?
The Classic Rock Web Stream from 94.7 WCSX.
Took a look down a westbound road, right away I made my choice. Headed out to my big two-wheeler, I was tired of my own voice. Took a beat on the northern plains and just rolled that power on.
heard of a little thing called the internet?
94.7 WCSX, just a bit before 6 o'clock, coming up at 6. It's the Peter Werby program. Right after that, it's Sunday morning over Easy 313-298-WCSX. Get the early morning suggestions in. We'll write them down. Pam will get them on the air for you. Again, coming back in just a few minutes, we'll join Peter Werby. He's getting ready for the show next on CSX.
Take a ride in a Ford. Just a Bourbon Ford dealer ride.
Smart Money's best new car value in a mid-size car. Now get $1,000 cash back on a 2007 Ford Fusion. Or eligible Ford employees can lease a 2007 Ford Fusion i4 for as low as $178 a month with a 24-month low-mileage red carpet lease. Ford Fusion. Nicely equipped. Great fuel mileage. Up to 31 miles per gallon. EPA estimated highway driving. And all that for $178 a month with 2028 cash due at signing. Includes acquisition fee. Excludes taxes, title, and license fee. Cash due at signing is net of all rebates. Take new retail delivery from dealer stock by 1-207. See your Suburban Ford dealers for complete details. See Palmer Motors Chelsea, Bill McDonald, St. Clair. Ford. Bold moves. See Skelnick Ford Lake Orion, Varsity Ford Ann Arbor.
There's a mystical place where sun worshiping is more than an art. It's a religion. Welcome to the Mayan Gold Coast. Welcome to Cancun. From our legendary white sand beaches to our clear turquoise waters, no place captivates you like Cancun. Discover our five-star resorts, world-class spas, restaurants, and boutiques, and Mexico's most picturesque championship golf courses. Swim with dolphins and explore 3,000-year-old temples. There are many places that can tan your body, but only Cancun can tan your soul. For over 30 years, Funjet Vacations has provided getaways to Cancun perfect for every style and budget. Now you can save up to $500 per couple on select winter vacation packages to Cancun with Funjet Vacations' semi-annual Fun Saver Sale going on now. Just call your travel agent or visit Funjet.com by November 23rd to take advantage of these amazing savings. Plan your Mayan Gold Coast getaway today. Mexico, beyond your expectations.
Is America's youth getting too rich? Switching to Comcast Digital Voice Home Phone Service is saving families so much money, kids are seeing staggering increases in allowance. Many schools have overhauled gym class to include croquet, sailing, and equestrian dressage. And instead of baseball cards, children are trading luxury treehouse timeshares. So are the savings too much? With Comcast's unlimited local and long distance, voicemail, and 12 calling features, area parents aren't complaining. From the playground, Leslie Barnes.
Get Comcast Digital Voice for as low as $33 a month for 1 year. You'll get unlimited local and long distance plus voicemail. Just call 1-888-COMCAST. Offer ends 12/31/06. Comcast Digital Voice, digital cable, and high-speed internet available for $33 per month each when you subscribe to all three for 1 year. Limited to new customers. Not available in all areas. After promotional period, regular rates apply. Activation and equipment fees may apply, and price does not include applicable taxes and fees. Savings based on multiple product rate versus standard rate. Other restrictions apply.
You stay the course. You don't give up, and you don't listen to naysayers. With nothing more than a sense of direction and a willingness to work, you're building your business brick by brick into something you can really be proud of. That takes determination. It also takes a bank that knows what you know, that you can't win the game with your nose in a rule book. Comerica is that bank. Nearly 150 years of business banking have taught us that going exactly by the book is not exactly smart. That it's important to have faith in people and ideas as well as numbers. And that enduring relationships are what make business work. So whether you need help with financing, wealth management, business succession planning, or company buyouts, call Comerica at 800-889-2025 today. Comerica Bank. We listen. We understand. We make it work. Member FDIC.
94.7 WCSX, Detroit's Classic Rock Station, just a bit before 6 a.m. a Sunday morning. A lot of you early risers getting up with a coffee and paper. Some of you already at work, just like moi. Either way, we're here for you. Peter Werby, always here for you on early Sunday morning. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Thank you very much for joining me. A pleasure to be with you. For me, at least, one of the hardest authors to interview is someone who's written a novel, because... Yeah, you got to. You can't give away the story. You can get the broad outlines, but there often are novels that are have a close bearing on reality. And this one particularly I found very beguiling. It's called The Woman I Left Behind. It's a novel, and it's written by Kim Jensen, who I will introduce to you in just a second. It's the story of a love between a Palestinian exile and a young American woman, and it explores the difficulties of intercultural relationships. And I think that certainly is interesting in and of itself. But when it's also overladen with a culture from another area of the world, there's more there. And also, it's a glimpse into Palestinian history and culture. Joining me is the author,